Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. I'm glad we can be together once again. I'm glad this is a place we can set aside our daily worries for a little while and turn our minds to something beyond ourselves, something that speaks to the larger truths we feel all around us, something eternal. I hope you're taking care of yourselves, staying healthy, staying sane, cutting yourself some slack, which is something we tend not to do. I try to do it for myself. I might do it for myself too much. Maybe I'll do it for you guys too. You know, I'll cut you slack. All right? You got it. There. I'm giving you slack. Enjoy. And remember, there's been a lot of good times in the past. There will be a lot of good times in the future. And I hope for many of you, there are good things happening right now. Quick reminder, the 26% off sale for the year 2026 is still happening at RichardHaddam'sParanormalBookshelf.com. Just click on shop exclusive merch. We're almost sold out of the spiral bound notebooks, so please, someone, order the last few so I can get them out of my office. We'll probably do a second run with a slightly different design, so if you want this edition, now is the time. And I want to thank all of you who have jumped into the conversation on Spotify. I love the comments. We've been going back and forth. So please rate and review on Spotify. Leave a comment. I am always in there checking to see who's saying what. And it really is fun to talk to you all. And if you're on Apple, please give us a review on Apple. I love reading those things. So please rate and review us on Apple. It really does help. All right. I think that's all for now. Wherever you are listening, I hope you're safe and healthy and ready to take a little road trip with me, because we are hitting the road. Here comes Jadu. Here we go. Jadu by John A. Keel. Jadu by John A. Keel, Julian Messner, New York, 1957, is a masterpiece of the kind we don't see anymore. It is the story of a young man who sets off on a journey across the Far East, all by himself, to explore the still mysterious tombs of Egypt, temples of India, and deserts of Iraq. For John Keel, all roads lead to magic, but the magic must be based on tricks. And if there are tricks, he wants to know the secret behind them all. You see, right around the age of 12, just before serious puberty sets in, boys and girls each go through a stage of obsession. For girls, it is horses. For boys, it's magic. There are special powers out there, and boys want to know how to wield and control them. John Keel was no different in this regard. He spent hours in the barn loft of his parents' farmhouse in Hornell, New York, practicing magic tricks he learned in cheap paperback books. At school, he even earned the nickname Houdini. But he also read about places on Earth where, if legend was to be believed, the magic was real. And if it was, he was going to see it. And he did, when he was just 24 years old. He gave up his safe, secure, and semi-creative job writing radio shows for the American Forces Network in Frankfurt, Germany. From the book, quote, "The Middle East fascinated me, with its atmosphere of mystery and antiquity. Every night I pored over maps while images of shining cities and lost tombs and temples danced in my mind. I wanted to see my name in print. I wanted to write and nothing else. I wanted to see India and get a first-hand look at the celebrated feats of the fakirs, to explore the Himalayas, to investigate the firewalkers of the Pacific Islands. I was going to write my way around the world." Keel sets off for the Far East in 1954 at a time when, quote, "there are few corners of the world left where the wheezing rattle of automobiles and the monotonous drone of radios have not brought some form of enlightenment and crushed ancient practices and superstitions. Those few corners are my bailiwick. Those places still haunted by Jadu have provided me with the material for my magazine stories. They are the corners this book is about. And over the next 280 pages, we are dragged along by Kiel for every dilemma, downfall, and bout of diarrhea. But we also get to ride alongside him as he essentially turns himself into a real-life Indiana Jones. Quote, "One of the first places I visited was an obscure spot in Egypt where I met a man who earned his thin livelihood catching cobras with his bare hands. When I was a small boy," the man said, "my father came to me with a cobra bite on his finger. I had to take my axe and cut it off. He lived." Later, that man allows Kiel to join him on a hunt for deadly snakes in the desert. Along with his brother and nephew, the man shows Kiel how to catch a cobra. Basically, once they find one, the group surrounds it and takes turns attacking it with wooden hoes. From there, it's just a matter of exhausting the snake until it is tired and confused, and then slipping it into a canvas bag. This is often the punchline to Kiel's stories. What is at first shrouded in mystery soon reveals itself to be something far more mundane. Still, Kiel tells us, quote, "Death is no stranger to the snake hunters. Whenever they go out into the desert, they are bold, but they are afraid, too. They know the desert will never really submit. They know someday it will kill them, too." These are men, of course, whose skills have been passed down through generations, who have spent years learning their trade. But Kiel has no compunctions about joining them for an afternoon. Sure, he could die, but there might be an article there. In 2 months, he might have $50 to show for it. By the time John Kiel was 25, he was traveling the globe, untethered to anybody or anything but his dream of adventure. "When I was 25, my life was set in stone. I was married to Michelle Goodwin, and I spent my days exploring the 3 or 4 blocks around our house on Keystone Avenue in Pasadena, walking the dogs or maybe having lunch at the little Thai restaurant on Colorado Boulevard before returning to the small room at the back of our house to spend countless gray hours toiling away on one doomed script after another. It was the life I had chosen, the life I had insisted upon, declining all others that had been offered. I first read Jadu years later as that marriage was ending, and I marveled at the clear simplicity, the inevitability of Kiel's life, moving from one adventure to the next, first the mysteries of the Far East, but then the mysteries of reality itself, as he crisscrossed America hunting for UFOs and finally following the fickle finger of fate to Point Pleasant, West Virginia, where he met and then introduced the world to Mothman. At a time when I had never felt more burdened by my decisions and very real family responsibilities, I was completely enamored with Kiel, who appeared to have lived his life fully and on his own terms with no regrets. We had each chosen the life we wanted, and I couldn't help but envy his choices. But I didn't have all the information, and as it turns out, I wasn't the only one living with regrets. In Egypt, Kiel became fixated on a word he heard whispered to him in the back alleys of Cairo, Jadu. It is a Hindu word for black magic, and it brought terror and dread to anyone who heard it because it spoke of a supernatural world so vast and evil that no single word could truly encompass it. While I was in therapy, I became fixated on a different word, divorce. It was a word so terrifying and deadly, I couldn't hold it in my mind all at once. I'd start thinking about it, and then I would picture my children, Spencer and Owen, just 3 and 5 years old at the time, and I'd cut it off. But the word was always there, swimming around in my brain, just under the surface, a shadow in the water, waiting to swallow me whole. Speaking the word in therapy tamed it a little, but I hadn't said the word out loud to anyone in my real life. That was going to change tonight. I was having dinner with my old college friend, Pat Riley. He was in town from Las Vegas. I only saw him maybe once a year, But we were old friends, and I could tell him anything. So this particular combination of close but far away somehow made him the perfect person to confide in. Pat and I had met at USC Film School. Back then, we were headed down the same road. Write scripts, sell scripts, spend our lives making movies. At the time, the biggest difference between us was that Pat didn't see life as some cruel enemy that needed to be outsmarted and overcome. Or if he did, he never had any doubt that he would win. It was an exceptionally cold night in February of 2001. I was already sitting at the table at the Arroyo Chop House in Pasadena when Pat walked in. He was a little balder than the last time I saw him, and there was a bit of gray in his beard, even though we were barely into our mid-30s. But he had that same energy he always did, like he owned whatever building he entered. He looked at me, then tilted his head and said, "What's wrong?" "Jesus Christ," I thought, "is it that obvious?" "For fuck's sake," I said, "can't we at least order a drink first?" "Fine," he said, "but I'm cutting you off after one." I smiled. This motherfucker who knows me. This is why I knew he was the one to tell. And after all, once upon a time, 14 years ago, didn't we have almost the exact same conversation? Sunday, May 17th, 1987. Pat and I are sitting at a table in Ray's Tavern in Green River, Utah, looking out the window as 9 Harley Davidson motorcycles pull up to a loud, growling stop. The riders come in doing that slow motorcycle walk and fill a long table at the back of the room. I have never seen bikers in real life before, not like these. I feel like I'm in the first 5 minutes of an episode of The A-Team. 24 hours before, this cross-country road trip of ours was just getting started. We'd been in a Burger King in Barstow, California, and we were going to be on the road for almost 2 weeks, and I could already see an unending chain of chains unfolding before us. McDonald's, Denny's, Burger King, Wendy's. "Let's make a deal," I said. "For the rest of this trip, we won't eat a single meal in any place we've ever heard of before. Deal?" "Deal," Pat said. And so now here we were at Ray's Tavern. We found this place the way you did before smartphones. We pulled off the interstate and drove around town until we saw something that looked interesting and cheap. "Here you go, boys." The waitress set down 2 cheeseburgers, fries, and Cokes, plus plenty of extra napkins. I took one bite of the best cheeseburger I'd ever had in my life, then threw it down and said, "This sucks." And without missing a beat, Pat threw his down and said, "I'm not paying for this shit. Let's blow." He moved to get up, and then we both started laughing. And then we saw the bikers staring at us. "Just kidding, guys," Pat said, and he held up the chunky black Super 8 camera that he now carried everywhere and waggled it in his hand. "Just doing a scene. Seriously, though, get the cheeseburger. I highly recommend it." Pat was 21 years old, 6'3", and had a big black beard. In fact, he looked way more like he should be sitting with the bikers than with me. Oh, what did I look like back then, you ask? I looked like Matthew Broderick, just less macho. The motorcycle guys turned back to their beers, supremely uninterested in us. After all, they were old, grown-ups in their 30s and 40s. We were just a couple of stupid kids from L.A. When Pat and I hit the road yesterday morning, I knew exactly what I wanted. I wanted the feeling I was having right now. The giddy, untethered sensation of being completely free. We were 560 miles from home, further than I'd ever been, and my mood was finally lifting. Sure, I was worried about what I was leaving behind, and even more worried about what lay ahead. But for a few days, as we crossed America, I'd be in a neutral zone between my past and my future, outside the gravitational pull of either. Yet for all the fun and freedom it offered, this trip was, at its heart, still an obligation. Our destination was New Haven, Connecticut, which was code for Yale. My long-distance girlfriend, Michelle, had made it clear that she expected me to attend her graduation. My parents had made it equally clear that they weren't paying for me to fly there. But it didn't matter. I had waited 4 long years for her to finally be done with Yale and come back home. I wasn't going to fuck it up in the final seconds of the game by missing her graduation. If she wanted me there, I would figure out a way to be there, whether I actually wanted to be there or not. My mom was against the relationship, and always had been. But I knew Michelle was expecting a total commitment. I was stuck between these two women whose emotional well-being I felt responsible for. Somehow I had to keep them both happy. Why couldn't they just get along with each other, linked by their love for me? Well, they couldn't. Sometimes I'd get the weird feeling that my mom felt threatened by Michelle, like she saw her as some kind of interloper. But that was crazy, right? How could a grown-up be threatened by a kid? Either way, someone was going to be unhappy. Either my mom or Michelle. Oh, and me. Me too. Always me. And it wasn't just my mom and Michelle I was disappointing. There were other people I was letting down. I had spent most of the last year dating a girl I knew from Alhambra High School named Jeanette Liu. After Michelle had told me the previous summer that she had slept with someone else, but it had been no big deal, I felt as if this was the new landscape of our relationship. We loved each other and didn't want to break up, but Michelle made it clear, if the possibility of me sleeping with someone else presented itself, it would not be a deal breaker for her. If anything, in fact, it would make her feel less guilty. Now, most guys would think of this as the perfect situation. Most guys. For me, it just felt weird and scary. Sex was a big deal to me, and I wanted it to be a big deal for her. I didn't understand how she could have slept with someone else and not have it be a big deal. But at the same time, there was a voice inside me saying, "You are not normal. In college, people sleep around. It doesn't save their lives. It doesn't ruin their lives. It's just a thing people do to try to figure out who they want to be with. That's why it's called casual sex. And just to be safe, you should probably be doing it too. Because what if you're wrong? What if your life path isn't set in stone? What if Michelle Goodwin is not the one?" I hated this voice. This voice seemed hostile and insane. It undermined my confidence and determination in a lethal and sinister way. It was like when people asked me, "So what happens if you don't make it as a writer? What's your backup plan?" I wanted to scream at these people, "There is no backup plan. There is no plan B. This isn't some goofy random dream. I am going to be a TV writer, and I am going to marry Michelle Goodwin. So it is written, so it shall be done." But then Jeanette Liu asked me to her senior prom. She was 2 years younger than me, but we'd been in a couple of plays together at Alhambra High School, and I'd always kind of liked her, and now suddenly out of the blue, it seemed like maybe she liked me. So we went to her prom, sort of as friends, but then we kept going out, and eventually decided that we would sleep together. But was it okay to sleep with her? It was okay with Michelle. I just wasn't sure if it was okay with me. Maybe if I could casually date other people with an open mind and a mostly open heart, I'd figure things out. My situation would resolve itself. Clarity would come. It did not. Whenever I was on a date with Jeanette, I felt like I was stepping into some other reality, a bizarro version of my life, alien and strange. In the past, when I had a crush on someone, it was primarily emotional. Something inside me got triggered. The person always had some deep emotional wound, some great pain that could not be resolved. And ladies and gentlemen, this is what made me horny. The idea that I was the one person on earth who could take their pain away and solve their life. But when it came to Jeanette, it was incredibly complicated because she wasn't a bird with a broken wing. And if she didn't need to be rescued, then what was I even doing with her? She was smart and funny and creative and sexy. I was lucky to be spending time with her. She liked me and I liked her. And I couldn't figure out how to actually be with her because she didn't make me feel as if the future of the earth depended upon me maintaining for her a certain mood, a precise emotional temperature that must always be held in exact balance, or all life on Earth as we know it would cease to exist. As far as I could tell, that was her only flaw. A few weeks before leaving on the trip, I broke up with her because I felt like it was the right thing to do. It was soulless and surreal and grimly efficient, like I was firing her. She knew about Michelle, and like Michelle, the fact that I was seeing someone else didn't seem to be a deal breaker for her. Still, she was shocked. For her, it came totally out of the blue. Even as I was breaking up with her, I tried to convince her and myself that I was simply being reasonable and logical and mature. But in reality, it was brutal, and I hurt her. And the worst part about it is that I tried to pretend I was doing her a favor. Pat and I finished our burgers at Ray's Tavern and got back into his light blue 1980 Volkswagen Bug and kept driving all that afternoon and into the night, heading for Denver across the Rocky Mountains in a rainstorm, swerving around hairpin turns on the slick asphalt, almost going off the road more than once, which would have absolutely meant our death. And all the way I stared into the narrow cone of headlights on the highway, wondering if there was a way for me to make a final course correction, and for the first time in my life, have the guts to let the unexpected happen and allow the future to meet me halfway. Back in Egypt, Jonquil was having his own problems. He was starving, and his stories had stopped selling. Here's how it worked. His system of survival involved writing stories on a portable typewriter that he had to keep in good working order at all times in corners of the earth where there was not always a typewriter repair shop around the corner. He would write, rewrite, and finally mail his articles to his agent back in New York, who would then try to sell them to any one of about 50 publications known as men's magazines, with titles like Saga, True, Argosy, Cavalier, Stag, Male, and Swank. If his agent managed to sell an article, he'd wire the fee to Keel, and that would be the money he had to continue eating, sleeping, adventuring, and writing for another few weeks. With Egypt written out and no new sales, Keel knew it was time to move on. He used his last few dollars to book passage on a boat from Alexandria to Beirut. And from there, he traveled to Baghdad, and finally to Bombay, India. Like a lot of us, Keel grew up reading Ripley's Believe It or Not, and it was there that he learned about the great mystical abilities of the fakirs, men who could pierce their bodies with knives and needles without evidence of blood or pain, men who could be buried alive for hours, days, or even years, and emerge from their graves healthy and well-rested. Men who could read from books with their eyes bandaged shut. And strangest of all, the men who could perform the infamous Indian rope trick. Did such men actually exist? If they did, Keel intended to meet them and learn their secrets. And to his credit, he managed to do exactly that. Let's begin with the human pincushions. Keel seems to run into these guys on every street corner in India. The most impressive of them are able to push narrow swords through their abdomens or throats. But Keel befriends a man who pierces his cheeks with a long hat pin, and for a few rupees, he shares with Keel exactly how it can be done. With your tongue, you find a spot inside your cheek that is flesh but not muscle, usually about an inch straight back from the corners of your mouth. From there, all it takes is nerve. With a sharp, piercing puncture, the narrow needle will pop easily through the membrane of the cheek and pass again through the opposite one with nothing more than a brief pinch of pain. Ever game, Keel borrows one of the man's hat pins. Quote, "I held it over a candle, hoping to sterilize it. I moved my tongue against my cheek and found what seemed to be a soft spot between two lumps of muscle. Then I carefully placed the point of one of the hat pins against my face. I braced myself and slammed the palm of my hand against the round end of the pin. There was a flash of pain as it went into my cheek and another as it came out the other side. Then there was no pain at all. The insertion had been no more painful than a bad shave or a doctor's hypodermic. When I drew the pin out again, the wound didn't bleed, and the puncture was hardly discernible. The next morning, it was gone entirely. Keel moves quickly on to discover the secret of the holy men who have the ability to be buried alive. Again, by bribing the right street performers, Keel learns not one, but three popular methods of pulling off this feat. The first, simplest, and most effective works like this. Quote, "The fakir climbs into a coffin designed with a false bottom. He is surrounded by members of his family and trusted followers who are in on the secret. The lid is nailed down amidst great ceremony, and then the coffin is hauled outside to the burial grounds. During this transference, his assistants crowd around the coffin so that it is practically hidden from view, and the fakir has ample opportunity to escape through the false bottom, dressed in a robe and turban identical to those worn by his mourners. He then slips away unnoticed. The coffin is buried in a prominent place, and the fakir goes into hiding for as long as a year. When the coffin is dug up again, the process is reversed. While the coffin is being carried back to the temple to be opened, the fakir slips back into it." I woke up in a motel room in Denver, Colorado. Everything felt new and clean in my life. I didn't know anyone in Denver, and nobody knew me. Pat and I drove northeast for an hour before getting breakfast in Fort Morgan. It was just some random diner, and we sat by the window looking up at a clear blue sky. I had a strawberry waffle and a whole pot of coffee, which they left right there on your table. And I felt the kind of unsullied hope and excitement that I hadn't felt since childhood. Pat and I sped on up I-76 to where it became the 80 at the Nebraska line. And as we crossed into the Cornhusker state, Pat bellowed in a high-pitched Jerry Lewis voice, "Oh yeah!" To which I replied, "Oh yeah!" And that became our ritual as we crossed any state line. "Oh yeah, yeah, yeah! Oh yeah, yeah, yeah!" Pat hadn't waited for Nebraska to play Nebraska, his favorite Springsteen album. He had it on cassette, and I had my favorite album on cassette too. Never mind the bollocks, here's the Sex Pistols. So that's what we played, one after the other, over and over again. And when we finally got sick of those, we tuned into whatever local radio station we could pick up. And then it was that endless magical playlist of early summer 1987. Luca by Suzanne Vega. With or Without You by U2. Don't Dream It's Over by Crowded House. I Want to Dance with Somebody by Whitney Houston. Always by Atlantic Star. Nothing's Gonna Stop Us Now by Jefferson Starship. Just to See Her by Smokey Robinson. I Just Died in Your Arms Tonight by Cutting Crew, which always reminded me of Jeanette. And The Lady in Red by Christa Berg, which didn't remind me of anyone, but instead conjured the gauzy image of a woman I didn't know yet, but could meet at any moment, always one magical night away, hovering in my future, waiting for me with open arms. When would I ever meet her? We spent that night in Lincoln, Nebraska, and the next day we blasted through Iowa. Usually on a trip, I'll bring two or three books along, at least one of them paranormal. But on this trip, I just had one, a thick, square, paperback copy of Lonesome Dove by Larry McMurtry. It felt completely different from any book I'd ever read before. "When are you going to write a novel?" Pat asked, sounding vaguely annoyed. And I suddenly felt exposed because I'd spent the last 2 days crossing America wondering the exact same thing. "I don't think I can," I said. "What are you talking about? Of course you can," he said, which was a very Pat Riley thing for him to say. Writing a novel is just the same as writing a movie or a TV script. It's just more detail. I knew what he meant. I'd heard other people say things like that before. But as much as I loved to fantasize about being a novelist, it felt outside my reach, outside my plan. I couldn't picture actually doing it, wrapping my arms around it. Like so many things I wanted or thought I wanted, it hovered just outside my grasp. Maybe I didn't have the parts for it. Maybe writing a novel required an organ of observation or some hormone of creation or an entire extra limb I didn't possess and never would. When I had thoughts like this, I felt my life narrowing down rather than opening up, options falling away one by one until all that was left was Michelle and TV writing. I thought knowing exactly what I wanted made me stronger than other people, braver. But now as the miles piled up behind me, and I entered physical spaces I'd never occupied before, with vistas that I'd never imagined, I began to wonder if I hadn't been a little too hasty in my imagining of my own future, and if wanting these things and just these things was less about courage and more about fear. At the end of our fourth day on the road, we pulled into Chicago, home of Ferris Bueller and Carl Kolchak, and Pat Riley. Pat actually grew up in Palatine and went to Fremd High School, where he met his three best friends, Craig Nevius, Mike Clark, and Eric Lombard. Pat described them as his Tim, Herb, and Larry, and he assured me we'd all get along great. And as usual, he was right. And by the end of that first night, it really did feel like we'd all known each other our whole lives. It happened to be the night of a non-official high school reunion party where they kept dragging me around to various strangers, trying to convince them that I went to Fremd too, saying, "You remember Rich?" And we'd see how long we could keep it going. To this day, there are people all over Chicago who think we went to high school together. Craig Nevius was a writer, and Mike and Eric were both actors, and they weren't kidding around. Like me, they absolutely knew they were going to become famous. Mike and Eric had headshot resumes and were getting auditions all over Chicago. Mike had his sights set on Second City, and he had this sort of Michael Keaton meets John Belushi vibe that was absolutely irresistible. Craig had even gotten some interest in a script he wrote called Happy Together, which actually did get made a couple of years later with Patrick Dempsey and Helen Slater. It was eerie how quickly I fell in with these guys. Was being in another city, making new friends, making a new life, really this easy? I'd never lived anywhere but Los Angeles. I went to USC Film School while living at my parents' house. I planned to work in Hollywood. It had never seriously occurred to me to live anywhere else. But other people had. Michelle had spent 4 years in New Haven, Connecticut. Pat had moved from Chicago to Los Angeles. I supposed I could write TV scripts anywhere. And what was stopping me from going to auditions or even trying out for Second City right along with Mike? Late that night, I called Jeanette. It was only 9:30 in Los Angeles, but when she answered the phone, it was in a harsh whisper. "It's me," I said. "I know," she said. I was the only person who ever called her house this late. I told her about my night with Pat and his friends and how I was feeling like maybe the future was more open than I thought it was last week. I wanted to sound different to her, be different. Mostly, I didn't want to be that guy that had cut her down and then acted like she was crazy for being hurt. I wanted her to be excited for me, and in the lowest reptilian part of my soul, I wanted her to say she'd take me back if that's what I wanted. But she didn't say that. She didn't say much of anything. She just seemed confused as to why I was calling, and calling so late. After all, I had just broken up with her. When I could feel that whatever it was I was trying to do wasn't working, I just said I missed her and, well, maybe we could have lunch or something when I got back. "We can have lunch," she said, "but we're not getting back together if that's what this is about." So I pretended to be shocked that that's what she thought this was, even though it was, and once again I acted like she was crazy and totally mistaken, when in fact, she'd seen through me perfectly.
You guys, my dream just came true. I get to do a live read ad for a product I actually use and love. I love Indian food, okay? It's probably, after like cheeseburgers, it's my second favorite of all foods. And I love meals that are healthy, fast, and simple to make. So I love the Cumin Club. Let me tell you what this is. These things, they come in packets. You order them, they deliver them right to your home. Here's the beauty. You just add water, you microwave. These things take less than 5 minutes. An Indian entree, ready to eat. It is so delicious. Okay, so let me tell you how I do it. I started off with the paneer tikka masala, which is not overly spicy. And it was perfect for me in terms of spice level. But then I did a second one. I had it with the dal chawal, which is sort of a buttery rice and lentil dish. And I mixed them together. That was my dinner. So the next day I did methi matar malai. You know, I'm sure I'm pronouncing this wrong. My South Asian listeners, you're going to have to tell me how badly I'm mangling this. But anyway, the methi matar malai, it's sort of a sweet, nutty cashew gravy with peas. If you've had Indian food before, I'd say this is like a korma, and it's fantastic. So I did that one with something called pav bhaj. Pav bhaj. It's a spicy veggie stew. Again, not too spicy. You don't need to be afraid. And it was the perfect lunch. Took me 3 minutes. But they've got like 20 more entrees I haven't even tried yet, so I am working my way through. When I'm sitting here writing the podcast, I will suddenly be starving, and that is my danger zone, because that's when I will literally go into the kitchen and grab a bag of Doritos and just eat the whole thing. Don't do that. It's not good for you. It's not good for me. And that's why the Cumin Club is a lifesaver. Like I said, you add water, you put it in the microwave. 5 minutes later, you're eating it. It's a delicious Indian meal you can feel good about. Here's what you do. Click on the link in my show notes or simply go to thecuminclub.com and put in the offer code RHPB. That's going to get you 30% off. I'll say it again. Go to thecuminclub.com or click on the link in my show notes and enter the offer code RHPB, and you're going to get 30% off. Not on your first order, not in your first two orders. You're going to get 30% off every single time you order. They're going to deliver it right to your door. Eat something good, healthy, and delicious. You deserve it. You're going to feel good about it. The Cumin Club, authentic Indian flavors straight from the source to your door. I'm going to go have some right now. What am I doing here? Talking about it? I'm going to go eat it.
Of all the tricks that Kiel exposed on his travels through India, the wildest and strangest is the rope trick. Because the way it's really done seems just about as impossible as the illusion itself. Now, while there's various versions, like there are of all great magic tricks, the classic version goes like this. During a show by Indian jugglers, which is their term for what we would think of as circus performers, a ginned-up feud erupts between the lead juggler and a young boy, one of his mischievous assistants. In a fury, the juggler grabs a coiled rope with a wooden ball attached to the end and throws it into the air, where instead of falling back to earth, it impossibly shoots straight up into the sky until it's essentially out of sight. The juggler then orders the assistant to climb the rope. The assistant, of course, is freaked out and doesn't want to. Then the juggler unsheaths a wicked-looking knife and threatens him, and so with no choice, the assistant climbs the rope. And soon, he too disappears from sight. Now, it should be noted that this trick is always performed outdoors, but never in full daylight, only at night. As he climbs, the young boy shouts down insults, until infuriated, the juggler clutches his knife in his teeth and climbs up the rope after him. Soon enough, they're both out of sight, but the sounds of a fight and then terrified screaming can be heard from high above, and suddenly, body parts are falling from the sky. The juggler then climbs back down the rope and gathers the hacked-off body parts of his former assistant into a large wicker basket. No sooner has the last piece been added Then the assistant pops out of the basket, miraculously reassembled into human form. Pretty cool, right? I would give just about anything to see even a bad version of this. Now, it takes Keel years, but a chance encounter brings him into contact with a mysterious man named Vadramakrishna, who seems to know all about him, his search, his past, and his desire to know the secret of the rope trick. "I've performed it myself, and I will tell you the secret," he says. "You have earned it." He begins his explanation, and 5 minutes later, Keel has the whole thing. He is stunned by its simplicity, but he reminds us the secret must be simple, for the trick has been performed for hundreds of years by traveling jugglers who had no sophisticated props to sell their illusions. Okay, here's how it's done. A thin, strong filament, like a wire fashioned from hair, is strung horizontally above the performance area, often as high as 50 or 60 feet. The show is always staged in a valley between two hills or rocky knolls. I know, it sounds crazy already. The filament is secured and operated on these hilltops by unseen assistants. Now, a second thread is looped over the first one, with one end dangling near the juggler, who attaches it to the wooden ball before tossing it into the sky, where it is then pulled quickly up and out of sight by another hidden assistant. And remember, this is all taking place at night, so none of these wires are visible. After that, it is up to the impressive acrobatic skills of the jugglers to ascend the rope and carry out the drama from the darkness above. You see, lanterns on the ground, operating as stage lights, cause the audience a kind of night blindness, so they can't really see what's going on up there. The boss juggler tosses down the clothed body parts of usually a dead monkey, which he has hidden in his robes, while the young boy travels hand over hand along the horizontal wire to the nearest hilltop, where he then makes his way back to the stage area and secretly climbs into the basket. The juggler climbs down, assembles the mutilated monkey parts into the basket, and the assistant triumphantly appears. By the time Keel learned the secret, the trick hadn't been performed for many years. The gullibility of the audience was key to the illusion's success. For the most part, they believed the performers had actual magic powers, and they didn't spend their time or energy trying to figure out the trick. Knowing he would have to perform the trick himself to convince anyone that he had discovered its secret, Keel prepares to do just that. He even calls a press conference of Indian, British, and American reporters to witness it. Now, you'll have to read the book yourself to find out how it goes, but spoiler alert, the trick is much harder to pull off than it sounds. And to me, it sounds pretty damn difficult. No matter, Keel's articles are finally selling. He's finding out the answers to the mysteries he's been tracking. He's a working writer, and the dreams he's been dreaming since childhood are finally all coming true. My second night in Chicago happened to coincide with Eric Lombard's 21st birthday. Craig Nevius, whose license plate reads Devious, planned a whole evening of classic Chicago activities that started with a giant steak dinner at a place called Gene and Giorgetti, and then continued on to a place called the Baton Show Lounge. It felt like an old-school nightclub, but since I'd never been inside any nightclub, it was all new to me. The place was packed. Birthdays, bachelorette parties, couples on dates. I got the impression Craig must have known someone on the inside because no one checked our IDs, and as soon as we sat down, this very glamorous woman asked what I wanted to drink. I figured I'd start out slow, so I got a Long Island iced tea. The name sounded very tame. Everyone at the table had already turned 21 but me. I was still 20 until November. But nobody here knew that. Nobody cared. Nobody knew I wanted to be a television writer or that I was going to marry Michelle Goodwin or that I'd never been inside a nightclub. I looked around the place and suddenly had the feeling that in here, I could be anyone I wanted to be. The lights went down. A spotlight came up and a woman came out and did the absolute best goddamn impression of Cher I had ever seen. I didn't know who she was, but I swear to God, if I didn't know any better, I would have thought it was Cher. whoever this woman was, she had talent. But if I thought she was good, the next woman was even better. She dressed, looked, and sounded exactly like Dolly Parton. The third act was Judy Garland, and I was on my second Long Island iced tea when I realized I was at a drag show. I turned to Pat and said, "These are all guys, aren't they?" And Pat looked confused and said, "What are you talking about? That was Cher, Dolly Parton, and that's Judy Garland." I had a moment of swooning disorientation. Was Eric gay? Is that why we were here? Were Craig and Mike gay? I knew Pat wasn't gay, and I was pretty sure I wasn't. But then in a sudden burst of insight, I realized, they're not gay. Craig and Mike and Eric and Pat are actors and writers, and they're Chicago guys, and they're more sophisticated than I am. For them, this is no different than going to any other kind of nightclub and seeing any other kind of show. It was the kind of place Ferris Bueller would go. I felt like a rube. And then I felt more grown up than I ever had in my entire life. Who was I? How did I get here? This is the kind of thing that happens when you don't have a plan. Finally, no plan. Was it okay to live without a plan? I felt giddy and lightheaded and deliriously happy, like I was having an out-of-body experience, like the whole world had broken open and anything was possible. To celebrate this feeling, I ordered a third Long Island iced tea. And let me tell you, they must have been making them weaker, because each one went down easier than the last. It may have been Eric Lombard's birthday, but tonight was the greatest night of my life. For about another hour. Then as we got up to leave, the world shifted sharply to the left, and I almost fell down. Pat caught me and maneuvered me back to the car. He shook his head. "God damn it, I should have stopped you after the first one." This sentiment was revisited about 15 minutes later when I started vomiting all over the back seat of Craig's car. He pulled to the curb and Eric gently guided me out onto the sidewalk where I crouched on all fours and puked into the gutter. He patted my back like he was burping a baby and said, "Don't worry about it, man. You're cool. Looking good. Hey, there's some girls coming over. Keep going louder. They love this stuff." I had never wanted to laugh and die at the same time. I didn't even know it was possible until tonight. After a while, I sat back on the curb with my head between my knees, gasping for air. Mike and Eric sat on either side of me. Pat and Craig paced around, trying to decide how to approach cleaning the back seat. I just kept saying, "I'm sorry, man. I'm so, so sorry." Craig said, "What the fuck, man? It was just a couple of guys in dresses." Mike leaned in confidentially and said, "Okay, here's what you do. As soon as you get home, I mean the minute you get home, go to the bathroom, sit on the toilet, and take a crap. No matter how long it takes. Don't leave the bathroom until you do. Tomorrow, you wake up, you'll feel great. Understand?" I nodded. I had no idea what he was talking about. But it didn't matter. I'd known these guys for 24 hours, and already, they seemed like the best friends I'd ever had. They seemed like my brothers. For 3 days back in May of 1987, anything seemed possible. Chicago was uncluttered with mountains, and the horizon spilled away in all directions, offering me a wide-open journey in any direction I happened to choose. There were so many roads to the future, and I could choose any one I wanted. For John Keel, the road took him due east to Nepal, where he had two experiences that redirected him, internally at least. Because rather than exposing tricks and revealing the mundane truth behind outlandish illusions, he ran into mysteries he could not explain. And he learned the value of being a true skeptic, which is, of course, investigating with an eternally open mind. His first encounter was with the Yeti, and his second was with a legendary Tibetan monk or lama known as Nyang Pass. Both left him with far more questions than answers. In the Himalayas, Keel learned that the Yeti, Bigfoot's Nepalese cousin, is considered more fact than legend, although few people have had first-hand encounters with it or want to. Keel's goal was to venture into the Himalayas and meet with the lamas and learn secrets And if he ran into Yeti along the way, so much the better. Traveling with guides, Kiel hears the strange call of the Yeti, a mournful cry that reminds him of seagulls in the distance. He eventually meets villagers who claim to have seen the Yeti as recently as the previous day. Finally, Kiel arrives in the village of La Chen, almost 9,000 feet above sea level. Near a marsh, locals point out tracks and fresh spoor, but no one seems as interested as he is in actually spotting the creature. He pushes on past the marsh, up a short rock-covered hill. There, on the other side of a small lake, he sees something. Quote, "Maybe it wasn't Yeti. I wasn't close enough to be absolutely sure. But something was out there across the lake. Something breathtakingly big and brown and moving swiftly, splashing through the shallow, icy waters toward a pile of boulders. As it neared them, another brown blur moved out to meet it, and together they disappeared beyond the debris of a landfall. The natives saw it too. They started to draw back toward La Chen, begging me to come with them, but I wanted a closer look." He pursues the creatures into a narrow channel between cliffs where, from above, he hears the familiar chirping wail he has heard before. He looks up and, quote, "High above me, there was a quick movement, a flash of brown against the gray sky. Then, only stillness and haunted emptiness. The Yeti must have climbed straight up the sheer face of the cliffs, something no bear or ape could do easily. A desolate sense of defeat came over me. I knew I couldn't climb those cliffs. I knew I couldn't get near those clever, evasive animals alone and unarmed. I stood there tensely for a long time, watching and waiting, aware of hidden eyes glued to me. Then I slowly backed out of the channel. That was as close as I ever got to the abominable snowman." Kiel's encounter 1 week later with Nyang Pass was more satisfying, if no less mysterious. Their meeting takes place in a small wooden dock, a simple kind of mountain cabin that are found throughout the region and used as crude, temporary shelter for travelers. Kiel, who up until this point had been scrupulously skeptical, seeking only to find out, quote, "how the tricks are done," witnesses things that defy explanation. Early in their conversation, Nyang Pa stands, leaning on his walking stick, then lifts his legs up off the floor until he is sitting cross-legged in the air. Quote, "There was nothing behind him or under him. His sole support was his stick, which he seemed to use to keep his balance. I was astounded. He conducted the rest of our conversation sitting there in empty space." The Lama explains that he is not a magician, simply a man practicing the teachings of his religion. Quote, "Think of an object," he says. "Try to clear your mind of all other thoughts and concentrate on that one object." Kiel thought of a tree. "That is too easy," the Lama said. "You're thinking of a tree. Try something difficult." Astonished, Kiel focused his mind on a pair of felt Tibetan boots. "Now you are thinking of a pair of boots," the Lama declared. After Kiel begged him, Nyang Pass taught him the trick, which was really not a trick at all. He told Kiel to clear his mind and focus on his subject. If the subject is a reasonably intelligent person who is able to really picture an object in their mind, an image of that object would pop into Kiel's mind. For the next few months, Kiel says, quote, "I made it a policy to try this on everyone I met. For a long time, it was just guesswork, and I was usually wrong. But recently, I've been getting surprising results. Unfortunately, however, few people are good subjects. They're unable to concentrate, or they don't take the experiment seriously, or they're so skeptical, they have a mental block which prevents them from projecting a thought. People with a higher education, such as doctors, military men, and newspaper men, are impossible subjects. Sensitive people, like actors, artists, and poets, People with strong visual imaginations make the best subjects. The object must be visualized. Words can't be intercepted by a novice telepath. Niang Pass then went on to describe something that you and I would now call remote viewing. Quote, according to Niang Pass, you just need to relax completely, concentrating on a road you know well. Follow that road mentally, visualizing every detail until you reach a point where your personal knowledge ends. Then try to continue beyond that point. If the experiment succeeds, and it probably won't, you can see things, places, and people beyond the scope of your knowledge and events happening at the moment of the experiment. Their discussion continues into the night. Thought transference, dematerialization, and tulpas. Thought forms brought to life through sheer concentration. It isn't hard for us in 2026 to see how formative this conversation was for Keel and how it led to so many of his future adventures and his theories about the metaphysical mysteries he encountered. When Keel and we reach the end of Jadu, he boldly declares that his real adventure is, quote, just beginning. Open roads in all directions, all over the world. There's no way he could have known how right he was. That was the book I read in 2001, 25 years ago. But in 2013, Anomalous Books published a new paperback edition of Jadu. And this version included never-before-seen material that Keel and his publishers cut out of the original edition. And it wasn't until I read this new version that I discovered that John Keel wasn't the man I thought he was. And he had some regrets of his own. Pat and I had never gotten lost on our trip, but now I felt lost. Those few days in Chicago had provided me with options, with a hazy, glowing vision of a different life. And isn't that what you're supposed to be exploring when you're 20? Exploring different cities, different people, different lives. We stopped for lunch at a place called Paul's in Milford, Connecticut, just about 30 minutes outside New Haven. It felt like a final meal. Pat chewed his burger and looked at me and said, "What's wrong?" How could I explain when I didn't really understand myself? I looked at Pat. Both of his parents had died before he graduated high school. And yet he lived his whole life with a complete and utter lack of existential dread. Pat was never alone, not if he didn't want to be. Girlfriends came and went, and none of the breakups seemed to upset him that much. In the years that would follow that lunch in Milford, Connecticut, Pat would pursue whatever he felt like, from screenwriting, to acting, to sitcom writing, to working in a large Hollywood agency. But none of those took off, not really, not quickly, or at least not quickly enough for Pat. So one day, without telling anyone he was even considering it, he applied to law school. He was accepted, and he never looked back. 40 years later, he's an incredibly successful lawyer in Las Vegas with a wonderful wife and kids and a second home in Lake Tahoe. If my motto was, endure and hope things get better tomorrow, Pat's was, life is short. Don't waste time on something that isn't working. Move on. Pat had asked me what was wrong. I considered his question and said, I've been waiting for Michelle to finish Yale and come back to LA for 4 years, but I don't know, am I being stupid? Should I do something else? Move somewhere? I can write anywhere. I wish I felt the way I felt a week ago when this trip was just starting. The minute I said it, I regretted it because A, I was onto something, and B, it scared the hell out of me. Have you talked to her about it? He said. Of course I haven't talked to her about it, I thought. What if she decides to stay back east? What if she decides to finally break up with me for good? No, I said, not really. You don't have to be with her, you know, Pat said. because of course he knew this had nothing to do with cities and everything to do with Michelle. You're good looking, you're funny, and besides Matt, you're the most talented guy I know. You can be with any girl you want. Pat saw as many roads ahead for me as he did for himself, branching out in all directions, offering vastly different but equally promising options. But for me, every option felt like a threat to my plan, the thing that would make me safe. What was wrong with me? As we drove the final miles to the Yale campus, I could feel all my options dropping away one by one until all that was left was the one road I was already on and had been on for the last 4 years, writing television and marrying Michelle. The story of Jadu, the one that I and the rest of the world believed to be the whole story, existed unquestioned for 56 years, from 1957 to 2013. The part no one knew was about a woman named Lita, and she was the love of John Keel's life. They met when he was 23 years old and serving in West Germany. They fell in love almost immediately. Quote, "There was a fascinating air of tragedy about her that made me want to draw her out, to get to know her better." "A bird with a broken wing? Run, John Keel, run!" And eventually he did run, although reluctantly. As strong as his love for her was, his desire to roam the Far East and fulfill his dreams of becoming a writer and adventurer was stronger. Quote, "Marriage was out of the question. The life of an unknown beginning writer is uncertain and insecure. My future was a blank. There was a strong possibility that none of my stories would sell, that I would become marooned in some out-of-the-way place and face more suffering than I'd ever known before." Keel felt he could risk his own future, but not hers. Quote, "Too soon, the day came when we had our last meal together in our favorite little restaurant in Frankfurt. And then we were in the train station choking out our final goodbyes. My train pulled away, leaving her standing on the platform, pale and stiff with fear and loneliness, trying to give me one last smile through her tears. The memory of that parting tormented me all the way to Egypt. I kept trying to tell myself that such decisions were part of the business of changing from a boy into a man. That she would forget, and I would forget. That our love was something that was not meant to be. But I could never convince my heart." They reunited months later. Against her family's wishes, she used her meager savings and traveled to Egypt. Together, for just a few months, they lived in his basement room in the slums of Cairo. From the book, "I'm sorry it isn't much," I apologized, ashamed, "but we'll move out of it as soon as I sell some more stories." "I will make it a home for us," she said bravely. And our new life together began. She joined me enthusiastically in my search for Jadu. Together we probed into the back streets. Together we spent long afternoons sailing the Nile in native feluccias. Together we wandered through the museums and the dark alleys of the Muskie, sitting sometimes in open cafes, drinking little cups of bitter coffee, and listening to the droning prayers from the loudspeakers on the mosques. Those were exhilarating, happy, loving days for both of us, in spite of the dark shadow of uncertainty hanging over our lives. We decided to marry, but we couldn't right away because of our tight financial situation. We couldn't afford the wedding ceremony and all the documents needed to link a German with an American in Egypt. So we hesitated. And in hesitating, we became lost. The sale of further stories did not come, and their financial situation grew worse and worse. What bothered Keel the most was his inability to provide a life for her, for the two of them. Failing on his own, that was one thing. Failing while she watched and taking her down with him was torture. Christmas came, and then New Year's, 1955. Quote, "Deep in my heart, I was terribly afraid. And the mere thought of leaving her again was a stabbing pain. She wanted to stay, and I wanted her to stay. She had sacrificed so much to join me, and our love had reached new peaks in Cairo. It was unthinkable to send her back, but the pressing decision kept us awake nights and diluted our happiness." After a letter arrives from Keel's agent, informing him that there have been no sales of his articles, they both knew it was over. Quote, "We read the letter together and cried like children. It was plainly the end. Reluctantly, tearfully, miserably, we decided to do the sensible thing. It was also the brutal thing." With the last of her money, Lita books passage home. They part for the final time on the deck of the ship that will take her back to Germany. Quote, "For a long moment I stood looking down into her sad, loving face, thinking of throwing her bags off the boat, scooping her up, and taking her back to Cairo. Later, a thousand times, I wished I'd done just that." The regret you feel when you are young is directed forward. Will I take a wrong turn? Make the wrong choice? Your entire future is at stake. And when you have dreams that demand to come true, the stakes feel very high indeed. Sometimes two dreams are in conflict, and so one of them has to die. By that night in February 2001, I had been keeping two dreams alive, or so I thought. But one was clearly dying. "I'm not sure Michelle and I are going to make it," I said to Pat. "You're talking about getting a divorce," he said. It wasn't a question. And as it turned out, I didn't have to say the word at all. The loud dinner sounds of the restaurant continued all around us, which seemed impossible when a piece of the world had just broken off and was now floating into the darkness of outer space. I nodded. "Rich, you need to do whatever you need to do to be happy. And I gotta tell you, it's been pretty clear for a long time that you're not." "Really?" I said. He gave a sad chuckle. "Yeah, and it's not just me who thinks so." A sense of all of our friends and what they might think about me and Michelle and our relationship shot through me. And I know he meant to be supportive, but it was awful. I was glad he supported me, but the idea of Michelle not being supported made me want to cry. We talked about it more, of course, because I had brought it up. But now that it was out there, on the table like a dead animal, I was done, and I wanted the night to end. I wanted to go home and see Michelle and suddenly realize that I was crazy, that things weren't anywhere near as bad as I thought. But they were. And I knew it. I was about to turn off a road that I had been driving down for the last 18 years. Where would the new road lead? Was it the right road? The wrong road? I wasn't sure. But I knew deep down that the road I'd been on half of my life was rapidly coming to an end. John Keel was 24 when he and Lita said goodbye on the deck of the ship in Alexandria Harbor. He had his whole life ahead of him. Did he dream that he would see Lita again and they would finally marry? Did he assume that one day he would find true love with someone else, and this time it would be the right time and it would work? He must have. No one thinks their life story is written at 24. But after that day in Cairo, he never did see Lita again. A sequel to Jadu was shopped, but never sold. John Keel's writing career continued, but never quite at the level he had dreamed. And in later years, he referred to his books, none of which were bestsellers or even very well known, as his Nobel Prize-losing works. He wrote and wrote for decades, up until the very end. And in his life, he learned the secret behind some of the oldest mysteries of the world. But the one he never figured out was love. Do any of us? John Keel never married. And the reprint of Jadu, with the missing material about his brief and unknown love affair with Lita, was published 4 years after his death. As I drove home from dinner with Pat Riley, I thought back to our road trip all those years ago, and how much had happened since then, and how much had changed. I had actually managed to do all the things I had dreamed of doing back then. But I realized on that short drive that night that that didn't mean things had worked out. I was exhausted. I felt tired and scared and completely played out. I was only 3 miles from home, but I wanted to pull over and go to sleep. I wondered if there really was still time for a course correction, a cosmic do-over. Maybe it's never too late and there are second chances. And maybe at a certain age, it's not about choosing roads. Maybe life is really just one long road, filled with twists and turns and potholes and detours and wrecks along the way. And maybe the greatest trick of all, but the hardest one to pull off, is to just keep going. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producers are Tess Feifel, Sailor Franklin, and Harrison Marks. Our sound designer, editor, and engineer is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver. Our website is by Kayla Lord. And our music, as always, is by Nima Kazaruni. Please join us next time as we delve into the world of spontaneous after-death communications with the super fun and wildly optimistic Hello from Heaven! Until then, be safe and be well. Find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.